according to the co-op radio clock, it is exactly 12 o'clock on the nose, bing, Pacific Daylight Time, and you are tuned to CFRO, Vancouver's Cooperative Radio, 102.7 FM, and around the world on cooperadio.org. And it is time now for the Animal Voices show, and here they come. So hold on, turn up your radios, and hold on to your hats.
Yes, and welcome to Animal Voices. In this program, we wish to celebrate the glory of the animal kingdom. And I believe that when people hear this message of understanding and realize how much we have in common with our kindred species, the animals, people will step out and speak out for the protection of our environment and the animals with whom we share this planet. Animal Voices is coming to you on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver. And this radio station is a non-commercial, cooperatively owned, listener-supported community radio station. We are located in the heart of Vancouver's downtown east side. Co-op Radio is a voice for the voiceless that strives to provide space for underrepresented and marginalized community. Thank you, Co-op Radio, for always being with us. Alan Jensen, thanks to you always for being our technician. My name is Carl Loskin, and in the studio today, we have Marge Adams. And Marge, what's happening today?
Well, one thing we're going to do today is have an interview that I did with Joanne Chang of Liberation BC, a real animal activist, and this was taken or recorded when she was just back from Taiwan in the Philippines, and she's going to be telling about that. And also I have an item that I want to tell the listeners about from the Furberry Defender recent newsletter talking about the killing of beavers in the city of Surrey, BC.
So the beavers are in the news and busy getting ready for the winter. Wonderful animals. Well, shortly we'll be speaking with Alka Chandna. She's the spokesperson for the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. That organization is known as PETA, based in Norfolk, Virginia. The subject will be scientific research and animal experimentation. That's the other word for that is vivisection. And of course, we'll be hearing in the second half of the program. So we'll be hearing from Joanne Chang. So some of the items in the local papers that caught my eye this week, we'll go over that, is that there was a very interesting article about that in the National Post that said more Canadians are traveling with their four-legged companions and hotels are extending a friendly paw. The hospitality industry, realizing that making four-legged guests welcome frequently brings their two-legged companions back on their next trip. A survey indicated that 75% of all the respondents would be more loyal to a hotel that hotel chain that accepted pets even when they weren't traveling with the pets. So, yes, they had an item here for all people who wish to travel with their pets and stay at a poor friendly hotel. And it says it's not called etiquette, it's called petiquette. So the petiquette is if you're traveling with your woggy or doggy, is comply with the local regulations and bylaws. So that's so obvious. And then clean the dirty paws before entering the establishment. And then also not to leave the pet alone in the room unless you have checked with the front desk. Well, the Globe and Mail also had an article that said a lawsuit threatened to unsaddle the horse sanctuary in Alberta that had prevented about 1,700 horses from being slaughtered. The lawsuit for $5.6 million arose from a person who was injured while riding one of the horses. Well, in Canada, you might not know this, but in Canada, every year we slaughter some 90,000 horses for their flesh, and it's exported all over the world. And Alan, over to you, and you have a little CD, do you?
So yes, I do, and I'm just getting it set up. I just wanted to mention, in terms of what you're saying about people having pets in hotels, I was camping 2 weeks ago. I was for over a week camping around central BC, and this one of the striking things is how many people now are in campgrounds with big campers and trailers and so on, and almost all of them have dogs. And it's in, you're talking about people who have a lot of older and retired people, you know, because they're camping after Labor Day when there's no kids around. And almost all of them have pets with them. It was quite striking how big of a thing this is. So I'm just going to switch over to this nice little piece.
Thank
of recording
you, Alan, for always being at the switchboard there. It's so complicated.
Animal research gives experimenters a paycheck, but it doesn't give us cures for human illnesses. Using animals is costly, it's cruel, inefficient, and it's old-fashioned. Sophisticated non-animal research methods using whole human DNA, for example, is where our money should go. Help us insist on modern research. Write People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. That's PETA, Norfolk, Virginia, 23510.
Welcome, Alka Chandna, and you're the spokesperson for People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and you have a very special place in our heart because of the work you do.
You're very kind, Carl. Well, that's reciprocated. Thank you so much for having us on your program today.
Well, no, you know, but people often say vivisection, and they don't really know what it means. So maybe you can give us a sort of a lowdown, because that's your specialty at PETA.
Yes, that's true, Carl. Definitely, I'd love to do that. Well, you know, hundreds of millions of animals are used in laboratories around the world. In Canada, the number is around 2.5 million, according to the Canadian Council on Animal Care. Now, to imagine what these animals' lives are like, imagine living your entire life in a phone booth. Basically, you can take one step in each direction, but that's essentially it. You have no control over anything that you do. You're fed meals through the day, but it's the same stuff all the time. You have nothing to engage your mind, and the only interaction you have with anybody else is when somebody picks you up to perform some kind of invasive, perhaps painful, confusing, distressing procedure on you. People think that perhaps animals are treated well. That's not true. People think that perhaps laws protect animals. Again, not true. There are laws in place, but these laws are really housekeeping regulations that dictate the size of the cage, the humidity, the temperature, these sorts of things. But in Canada, as well as in the United States, there is no law that prohibits any type of procedure on an animal, no matter how pointless, no matter how cruel, no matter how duplicative. So it's a pretty sad situation for animals.
Now, what are the? It's so much of it is they're expanding the animal experimentation laboratories at the University of British Columbia and at Simon Fraser University. But so, what kind of stuff are they doing here, there, and why do they validate it? What are the arguments that counter that this is not good science?
Sure, Carl. Well, you know, at the University of British Columbia, for example, there are experimenters there who are drilling holes into the skulls of marmoset monkeys. They will inject a toxin into the brains of the monkeys to basically get the monkeys to be off balance, to give them some kind of brain injury so that their behaviors will mimic what we see in people with Parkinson's. But these experimenters know perfectly well that what they're giving the animals is not Parkinson's disease. It's something that then has symptoms that look like Parkinson's, but it's not the disease. Meanwhile, there are other experimenters at UBC, again, who are giving electroconvulsive shock therapy treatments to induce seizures in monkeys. You know, the history of doing neurological studies on monkeys is so long. For decades it's been done, and really they've gotten nothing from it. So many stroke drugs have been developed using monkeys, but these drugs only work in the monkeys. They have never worked in human beings. There was an Alzheimer's vaccine that was withdrawn in 2001 because it caused serious brain inflammation in patients, even though it had been studied and proven, quote-unquote, to be safe and effective in monkeys. You know, the problem is that even when you're looking at primates who are so much like us, you know, they're social beings, they have advanced cognitive abilities, they have such interesting personalities, they're individuals, and even though they are so much like us, in trying to translate results that you get from monkeys to human beings, it simply does not work.
So aspirin kills cats and penicillin kills guinea pigs. Why don't these scientists just get it? I mean, it's beyond me.
You're right. You know, Carl, that's a $100 million question. And maybe in saying that, I've answered the question. I mean, it really is an issue of money. You know, there are grants being given in Canada by groups like NSERC, which, of course, is federal, the National Sciences and Engineering Research Council, MRC, the Medical Research Council. These funding agencies are taking Canadian tax dollars and then doling them out, you know, in huge sums to all of these different vivisectors across the country. You know, there's another UBC experimenter who uses kittens to do sight experiments and to study the visual cortex. And he'll take these four-week-old kittens to do these studies. They have a partnership with Dalhousie University out in Halifax. And in Halifax, what they're doing is they're taking kittens and they raise them in the dark for 4 months. So for 4 months, these kittens never see daylight at all. You know, some experimenters do something as vile as actually stitching the eyes closed of these animals or fitting them with goggles so they can't see anything. But, you know, it's absurd because the cat's eye is so different from the human eye. We know that when humans are born and they're visually impaired that there are developmental issues, but making cats suffer doesn't help the human beings. It doesn't give us insights into how you can help those human beings. So it's just adding to the amount of suffering in the world and not really addressing very much of anything.
Now you're talking about tax dollars, and that's a critical issue here that you're explaining that. But we have these foundations like the Terry Fox Foundation and Rick Hansen, and they're considered to be icons, heroes. What kind of experiments are they doing?
Well, you know, certainly the funds that are raised by the Terry Fox Foundation and the other groups where you have people who suffer from certain diseases and they attain a certain iconic stature, you know, all of that money is being funneled into the same type of experimentation, which is painful. You know, there, for example, the spinal cord experiments that are being done, those are so hideous. And I read an experiment just earlier this morning at the University of Alberta, where experimenters have received a lot of money, and what they've been doing is they inflict brain and spinal cord damage on cats, and then they force the cats to walk on a treadmill. And the way they force the cats to walk on the treadmill is that they have basically a shock pad at the bottom of the treadmill, so if the cats don't walk on the treadmill, they get shocked, so they're forced to walk. And what the experimenters then do is they watch the way that the cats are walking. You know, you don't have to be a scientist to understand that cats have four legs, we have two legs. The difference in the structure of their spinal cord is sufficiently great that you don't want to be studying cats if you want to understand spinal cord injuries in human beings. You know, it really makes no sense at all. And again, we've seen that millions of animals have been used, billions of dollars have gone into this industry, and we really have nothing to show for it.
Now, you explained it very graphically about the cat, but, you know, this, the other thing is that the Rick Hansen, he's a wheelchair man in motion, and he had spinal cord injury, and so one would think that he would understand what it is like to break a spinal cord or have spinal cord injury. And that's exactly what he's doing to these sentient creatures. I mean, I feel really sad about that.
You're absolutely right, Carl. I mean, there should be greater empathy on the part of people who have been sick. And certainly we see wonderful groups like the Incurably Ill Against Animal Research, groups like that who speak out against the use of animals. But, you know, it's such exploitation because naturally we feel grief and we feel sorrow for people who are suffering. Most of us know people, you know, who have had cancer or heart disease or some such thing. But by funneling money into pointless experiments that will not give us the answers that we need, we're no further along. And instead, we see that animals have been exploited, human beings are being exploited, you know, suffering is being exploited, and it's just a compounding effect of more and more pain and suffering for no good reason.
Now, you explained the difference between humans and why should we be doing these animals on these tests on animals when humans, when many of these experiments don't work on work on animals, but wouldn't work on a human body. But maybe you can comment on this, that even within the human species, like Asians and Africans and Caucasians, different drugs have different effect on these do you call them?
you're exactly right, Carl, and that's such an excellent point because these days, you know, we hear people saying, well, we need to do more cardiac experiments on cardiac drugs for women because the cardiac drugs research that has been done so far has been primarily focused on men. Or we hear about these differences in racial populations, ethnic populations, these sorts of things. And then you have to ask yourself, well, if you're testing a drug in a guinea pig or a rat or a mouse, exactly how will that be applicable to human beings if you can't take results applicable to men and say that they're applicable to women? And this shows the extent to which animal experimentation is such an old technology. It's outdated science. I mean, it never was science, but it's outdated methodology. You know, these days, the methodologies that we're talking about are so refined that we can talk about targeting drugs to certain populations, drugs that would be more effective in African Americans or in Asian Americans, you know, rather than Caucasians, let's say, or drugs that would be more effective in women. But clearly, when you're talking about going from one species, like a rodent species, to humans, you're not talking about that level of sophistication. So we really have to get beyond the use of animals and look at these sophisticated modern testing technologies that exist.
So maybe you can explain some of the modern techniques, something that is viable and which should be accepted. And I believe that many of the advanced universities are not expanding their animal labs, but are using different techniques that are more reliable.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, Carl. And, you know, I should mention that just last summer there was a report published here in the United States by the National Academy of Sciences, which is the preeminent group of scientists that advises the government on scientific issues. And this report was called, and people can look this up online, Toxicity Testing in the 21st Century. And if you read that publication, the report that they authored, basically, it reads like, you know, something that an animal rights person would say, somebody who is aware of these issues. You know, they would say, well, animal testing is crude, it's expensive, it's slow, and it doesn't give reliable results. And on the contrary, modern testing technologies are faster, they're cheaper, and they're more reliable. And that's exactly what the NAS report said. But, you know, some of these technologies include things like using the high-speed computational processes that we now have. You know, we have computing speed like we've never seen before, along with all the databases of biotechnology, genetic information. And this is where you get into knowing about differences between men and women, differences between different racial, ethnic populations, and so on. but you have all of these databases and understanding of biochemistry, how different chemical compounds interact with one another. And with high-speed computing, high-power computing, we can crunch all of that information and get then data about how certain compounds will interact with the body. And not just your body or my body, but we could say, you know, your co-host's body particularly, so that a drug could be really designed and tailored for one individual. You know, that really is the future of this technology. But we see that bioinformatics, which is basically what I've just described, is taking place today. It's being used in industry. There are also silicon wafers that are developed. And, you know, one example is something called the Hurel chip. The Hurel chip, which is short for human on a chip, is essentially a silicon wafer. And the silicon wafer has different layers in it. And each layer represents a different organ system. So you'd have, and in those layers, they inject human cells from that organ system. So you might have, in this chip, you might have one layer that represents the circulatory system and another layer that represents the digestive system, another layer that, let's say, represents the liver, and so on. And then you would inject the chemical substance that you're testing into one end of the layer, and into one end of the wafer, and then the substance would just interact with all the cells, and you could see if there are problems. You know, if you see that the cells in the liver compartment are dying, you know that this substance is going to be toxic to the liver. And then we're not talking about a rat liver or a mouse liver or a dog liver. We're talking about a human liver. So, you know, this is the sort of advancing science that we're seeing. The Hurel chip is one. The liver toxicity chip was developed by people at MIT and the University of California, San Diego. It's another chip. There's something called the virtual human, virtual organ systems. And here we're seeing that biologists, medical practitioners are getting together with people in Silicon Valley and putting together, again, high-speed computing, modeling principles, mathematical modeling, with knowledge of biosystems, and getting really advanced, robust systems whereby they can find out about drug efficacy, drug safety systems, and so on. By the way, I apologize for the noise. All of a sudden, they started doing construction outside of my apartment.
It's okay. We can hear you, Alka. Well,
okay.
You know, your webpage is stopanimaltests.com. I think everybody should go and have a look at that, stopanimaltests.com. And we're speaking with Alka Chandna from People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. My co-host, Marge, has a question for you.
Alka, I don't know if I can express this question very clearly, but I'm thinking about the laws. And I believe that animal testing is somehow part of our laws, and that they give a blind kind of an opportunity for the drug companies to excuse themselves if the drug doesn't work, and
right.
They can say, well, it did work on the animal, so, you know, our
right.
conscience is clear.
Yeah, Marge, you're absolutely 100% correct. This is a huge problem that we're facing. This is what we call regulatory testing, when the government requires that animals be used to test substances. Now, to be clear, the government requires that pharmaceutical compounds be tested on animals, industrial chemicals have to be tested on animals, pesticides, herbicides, these sorts of things. And this is something that PETA has been challenging for quite a while now. Just a few years ago, the FDA in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration, which is the agency that requires these tests to be done on animals, these toxicity tests, the pharmaceuticals on animals, the FDA came out and they admitted that of all drugs that test safe and effective on animals, 92% are found to be either unsafe or ineffective in human beings. So you're talking about a 92% failure rate of animal use in drug testing. You know, so it's really no surprise when that's the case that we're seeing so many withdrawals. I think there was a government accountability survey that was done. They found that 52% of drugs that had been released over a certain period of time had been either withdrawn or relabeled for serious side effects that had not been found in animal testing.
And yet the companies were not held responsible for any of the results of those failures, I guess. Huh?
Yeah, it's a real challenge, you know, and this is always going to be the question, what happens in a court of law when a company is going to be challenged on this. But we have seen in our investigations that when companies, for example, we did an investigation inside Covance, which is a contract testing laboratory. It's the largest in the world. And they use animals, monkeys, dogs, and other animals to test drugs for their client companies, who are the big pharmaceutical companies. And what the pharmaceutical companies will do, we saw this in our investigation, is that, for example, they'll try to test a drug in one species, and maybe in that species they'll find that the drug was toxic. So they'll use another species. And they keep on going into different species until they find that they can put together the best picture possible for the drug so that they can finally get it into human beings, because that's what they want. So this ability to really shape the data to their liking introduces a profit motive into what's supposed to be a science, to really make for an unhappy situation for both animals and human beings.
Really frightening, isn't it, when you think of getting a prescription?
Yeah, it really is. I mean, after the animal tests, there are three stages of clinical tests. And, you know, what we try to point out, and, we see this when we look at the clinical tests, is that after the animal tests, I mean, essentially with the animal tests, nothing is being done as far as ensuring safety. You know, as we said, a 92% failure rate. So the first people who are involved in the clinical tests, even though the doses are low, they really are, you know, the first guinea pigs, as it were. Mm-hmm. There was a case just last year in the UK where there was a drug, and it went into the first stage of clinical testing, so with human beings, and there were six very healthy, young, robust men who were enrolled in this testing, and all six of them became severely ill. They went into ICU, the intensive care unit. They were suffering through organ failure. And, finally they were brought out, and nobody died, thank goodness. But all six men to this day have not worked. They've become very debilitated as a result of this whole thing. And the thing to remember about this case is that this drug that debilitated these men permanently was tested to be safe at 500 times the dose that was given to them in monkeys. It's such a failed system, and the tragedy of it is that animals are dying, human beings, taking these drugs are unsafe, they put their own lives at peril, and meanwhile, there are fantastic technologies, modern technologies, sophisticated advanced technologies, using the wealth of all the science that's known to us that could be used. But, government works at a government snail's pace, and changing governmental requirements is very difficult. And, of course, here in North America, we're way behind what the Europeans are doing. In Europe, although the regulatory tests still exist for pharmaceuticals, there are many non-animal tests that are allowed and have been validated. About 34, 35 tests have been validated that are these, modern non-animal testing technologies. And by comparison, in the United States, only four have been validated.
Now, Alka, in your webpage, stopanimaltests.com, you also mentioned there, we only have a couple of minutes left here, that the World Wildlife Fund is providing funding for animal tests. I mean, that is so strange. I mean, that's on your webpage.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. You know, some of these environmental groups, especially the large bloated ones, find that they want to support animal tests. For example, NRDC, the Natural Resources Defense Council, NRDC, as you mentioned, Carl, the World Wildlife Fund, these groups want a lot of testing done of chemicals to ensure that they're safe for the environment. Now, we don't oppose that. We think that that's good. But we oppose that the test should be done on animals, for all of the reasons that we've already discussed. Again, in a sense, the environmental groups give power to the companies that are producing the chemicals, because the companies that are producing the chemicals, the various pesticides and so on, they can do what we just discussed. If they want to say, well, this chemical is safe for the environment, and they're going to do it by using animal tests. Well, they can just find the species by going, you know, from one species to the next, to the next, to the next, before they find those species for whom the chemical is safe. But that doesn't tell you anything about whether the chemical is going to be safe for humans. So, you know, you still have a big wild card out there. So it seems to us that the environmental groups are doing the environment, wildlife, and human beings a great disservice by insisting on these animal tests. And we are continuing to push them to say, well, no, we shouldn't use animal tests because these other tests are cheaper, faster, and more reliable.
So, Alka, if we're seeing that many of these reputable and well-known animal organizations like the WWF is promoting animal tests, then surely we should be looking at PCRM's, that's Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine. They have a cruelty-free label. So we should be looking at that to make sure that our donations are, in fact, animal cruelty-free.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, this is something, when we think about these issues of animal testing, animal experimentation, and, you know, all the whole gamut of issues with animal exploitation, it can be really devastating, but you're absolutely right. You know, the positive side of this is that we hold so much power through the choices that we make with our consumer dollars and our donation dollars. So certainly when we donate to funds, we should to groups, we should be very careful. And we should seek out this knowledge. And as you say, Carl, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, PCRM.org, is a great place to go to get that information.
Now, in closing, Alka Chandra, we really appreciate you taking the time and being on Animal Voices. It's your webpage is stopanimaltests.com. And maybe you can just give us a little summary of what we've had here and maybe close off with a note of optimism that there is reliable science there that is a viable alternative to animal tests, which are cruel and often fatal for humans.
Right. Well, you know, I would encourage people to go to stopanimaltests.com. You don't have to believe anything that I've said on this show, but you can see for yourself if you look at the video footage that we have shot in laboratories. These animals suffer so greatly. They control nothing of what they can do in their lives when they're incarcerated in these laboratories. So please take a look at what goes on with them. The workers are often underpaid, you know, the people who are technicians working in the labs, and they take out their frustrations on animals. So we've documented workers slapping animals, throwing them against cages, shaking them violently. And this is violence that I think when people see, they don't accept. So we are optimistic in that we know that if people could see what happens inside these laboratories, they would not accept that this is okay. It is not okay. And especially when you look at the payoff of what we've gotten for all of these animals to have been really tortured and killed in laboratories, it's absolutely not worth it. It's not something that can be justified. Something from which I derive a lot of optimism, and Carl, you referred to this or alluded to this earlier, so many medical schools these days don't use live animals in teaching anymore. And, you know, the top names that you can think of, Harvard, Stanford, Yale, all of the big Ivy Leagues and the big universities in Canada as well are not using animals for teaching in medical training, and that's really, you know, something, a reason for optimism. We see that the younger generation coming up is more sensitive to animals. They don't want to dissect. They don't want to be taking the lives of animals casually for the sake of getting a class credit. And I think that when you have that kind of sensibility, as these kids get older, they won't want to vivisect. They won't want to be joining that profession. And I think that's positive. And then finally, there's the science. The fact that we can get better results using better means that are both better scientifically and better ethically, I think, is a reason for optimism. So I look forward to a better world with a lot less suffering for animals, and it'll be better for people as well.
I think you've made the world a better place, and you've been just wonderful on this program for explaining it so clearly.
You're very kind, Carl. I really, really respect the work that all of you are doing over there, and I love British Columbia, so my hat's off to all of you.
We look forward to you coming to visit. We look forward to you visiting, and thank you once again, and goodbye for now.
Okay, bye-bye. Take care.
Thank you, Alka. Okay. And you're listening to Animal Voices coming to you on CFRO Radio 102.7 FM. And many of our programs, like this one today, we'll be posting on our webpage, animalvoices.org. And you can also go to Animal Voices if you'd like to hear more about, read more about vivisection. So not only it's stopanimaltests.com, but also animalvoices.org/ADAV. And you'll get a host of information which John Pranger has put up there. And he's the ADAV stands for Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. And it's been a British Columbia-based organization that's been, was founded in 1927. And so the consciousness has been there. It's been carried through for many, many years. Well, Alan, have you got a little bit of music? And shortly we'll be on with Joanne Chang. Yes, and you're listening to Animal Voices. Our webpage is animalvoices.org. Well, shortly we'll be having, Marge will be introducing Joanne Chang, but I get her emails all the time, and she's with liberationbc.com, and they're having a walk for the animals on in Stanley Park tomorrow at noon at Second Beach. So everybody's invited to come along and join the people and do something for the farm sanctuary. Well, I get these emails from Joanne, and many of the at the bottom of the email, there's always a little note, some wisdom. Apart from all the other wisdom that she gives us, she has these little quips. I've got three of them, and I think they're worthwhile repeating. And she says, concerned about global warming? Then go vegan. According to the United Nations, almost a fifth of global warming emissions come from raising animals for meat, milk, and eggs. That's more emissions than from all the world's transportations combined. And she has another one that she really likes. And it says, imagine if a parasite forces you to give birth to 5 children in 7 years. And each time you give birth, the parasite kills your child at 1 to 2 days old so that it can nurse from your breasts. Don't be a parasite. Stop eating dairy products. Well, we don't. But anyway, so that should be a lesson. That dairy products is so cruel. And then Joanne Chang has another one. It says, be kind to animals. Get involved in helping those who can't speak for themselves. Visit www.liberationbc.com. And over to you, Marge.
Oh, yes. Thank you, Carl. Certainly, Joanne Chang is very outspoken on behalf of animals. I think she's a very, very admirable young lady. She went to Taiwan and the Philippines about 3 months ago, and she was educating people about vegetarianism and getting a lot of really interesting feedback. We talked to her when she got back in Canada, and she told us all kinds of her experiences. So that's what you're going to hear right now. Joanne Chang is on the line, and as I mentioned at the beginning of the program, she's a very active member of Liberation BC. Joanne was in Asia for a full month, and at that time she was serving with PETA Asia Pacific. Now, most of you know that PETA is People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, and she was working as an intern with that organization, which has has an office in Hong Kong. Hello, Joanne, are you there?
Hey, Marge, how are you?
Oh, I'm well. I'm glad you're back, and I hope you had a wonderfully eventful time in Asia.
Yeah, it was actually quite eye-opening, and I learned a lot there, so.
I'll bet you did. Which countries did you visit?
I visited the Philippines and Taiwan.
Aha. Uh-huh. Now, Taiwan, you lived in Taiwan, didn't you?
I grew up there, yeah, for the first part of my life, yeah.
You must have felt quite at home.
Yes, yeah. Okay.
Now, what kind of work were you doing with PETA?
I was there as their Taiwan representative, sort of. So I was doing translations into Chinese and calling up media in Taiwan to pitch events and vegetarianism to the Taiwanese media.
Aha, I see. So how successful were you in getting these events covered?
It was pretty good. There was quite a lot of interest. One of the big projects we were working on was World Vegetarian Week. So we had various representatives, various interns from different countries. So I was representing Taiwan, and we had Australia and Japan as well. So we got our vegetarian recipes on local newspapers, and as well as a demo where we went dressed ourselves up in lettuce and got a lot of media attention that way.
That sounds like Liberation BC to me. Tell us about your demonstration, will you?
It was in Taipei during World Vegetarian Week, and me and Ashley Fruno, the founder of Liberation BC, who now works for PETA Asia Pacific, we stapled lettuce to these bras and shorts that we had on, so it looked like a lettuce bikini, and we stood in front of this this famous building called Taipei 101, and had signs in Chinese and in English that says "Turn over a new leaf, go vegetarian."
Aha! Did you get lots of attention from the public?
We did. People kept slowing down as they were driving by to take pictures of us. And because in Taiwan, actually, vegetarianism is quite popular.
Uh-huh.
So it was a message that was quite welcoming to the people.
And I suppose you were handing out recipes there, were you?
No, it was basically just done for the media. And because there in Asia, there's more of an opportunity for international pickup. And we were able to get some pickup in Hong Kong, Singapore, Thailand, and India, as well as Taiwan.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah.
That sounds great. So vegetarianism was a popular topic to be working on. How about the animal rights issue and animal welfare, that kind of thing? What sort of general impression did you get or general reactions did you get when you were working on those angles?
There's a need for it, and people are very receptive to the message. When we're out there leafletting, when we're out there with the animal rights message, people have never heard this message before in Asia, and you know the people are very open to it.
Oh, that's good
so
to hear.
There's no resistance like here. People already know what animal rights is about, and they already have an opinion about it.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas over there, it's just sort of they're just like a sponge sucking up all the information that we give them.
I see. Well, that's a good way to start, isn't it?
Yeah. It's great that PETA is over there because there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Yeah. Now you talk about a lot of work. You did finish a visit to a zoo in Manila. You know, you mentioned and shelters, animal shelters. Can you tell us about the zoo for a start?
Yeah, the Manila Zoo is pretty much like zoos you would see here maybe 30 years ago. The animals are in like barren cages with concrete floor and metal bars. It's very sad, and you know people just need to be educated about that these animals need more than just concrete floors. It was kind of heartbreaking to see there was this one monkey who was in just a barren cage, and he was reaching out of his cage because there were some greens growing right outside his cage, and he couldn't reach it.
Oh.
So we were taking pictures, and we decided to pick the greens and hand it to him. He grabbed the greens, and all he did was he wanted to sniff it. He just smelled it, closed his eyes, smelled it, chewed on it, and touched it to his face.
Mm-hmm.
That's all he wanted, just to be just that part of nature.
Yes, it really breaks your heart, doesn't it?
It really, really does. And the animals, you can tell they were depressed. Some of the animals just sat in one position for like 15 minutes, did not move. Some of them had ulcers and stuff like that, and they weren't treated because obviously it's a poor country and there's not going to be any care going into the animals.
Yes. What type of animals did you see besides the ones you mentioned?
There's an elephant that PETA is trying to get out of the zoo. She's there by herself on concrete floors with no water. No water to play in, and she's just gawked at all day. There's an orangutan who's in a big cell, a dark cell, all by herself. She just lays there and doesn't really seem very interested in life. Apparently, she's been there for about 20 years, all by herself.
Reminds me of that hippo that was in the Greater Vancouver Zoo.
Yes.
It's pretty sad.
And they do have a hippo there, and I was quite ashamed when I went there and saw that the hippo actually had a pool to swim in, whereas in the Greater Vancouver Zoo, it took them a long time before our hippo even got any water.
And a lot of pressure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, sure. And crocodiles, too, I believe you mentioned.
Yeah, there was the zoo was right on the side of the road, so you could hear behind the wall, you can hear the traffic, the city noises, and right next to all of the traffic noise is a pond for the crocodiles. There was about 21 crocodiles in a very small enclosure. Some of them were missing limbs, and the water was very, very dirty and shallow.
And now, who is operating this? Is it a private zoo, or would that be a public government operated?
I think it's government operated, and there simply is no funding for it. Even if there was funding, I mean, these animals are living in areas that they're not supposed to be living in. There's desert animals living in this really damp and moist tropical areas.
Not very healthy for them, certainly.
No.
You also visited a government-operated dog shelter in Taipei.
Yeah, there's a huge, huge issue with street dogs in Taipei. This is because people like pets, and the same as anywhere else, the pet industry creates these animals that are dumped, animals that are unwanted, and what we saw was very heartbreaking. Ashley and I went into a government-run pound. Basically, they're dog catchers that go on the street and take any strays, and they hold them in these cells until for 7 days, and then they kill them. So we went into this government-run shelter unannounced and saw the condition that the animals would normally be in. We found a dog that was laying on the ground with lacerations on his legs, cannot move. He is laying in a puddle of urine, and he was just left there to die.
Awful, terrible. Now, are dogs eaten in Taiwan?
Not anymore because of recently there's been pressure. There are local activist groups that work really hard on the dog issue. And in the past, I think in the past 5 years or so, they passed legislation, so now dog eating is actually illegal in Taiwan.
Well, there's progress for you, isn't it?
Yeah. That's however, wonderful. It's, you know, with dogs, like here, like anywhere else, it's the pet industry. People go into these pet shops and they just want to buy animals, and they don't see what happens to these animals because the dogs we saw at that horrible shelter, they were all purebreds. Someone bred them, a breeder or a pet shop, to be someone's beloved pet, and that's how they end up.
So is PETA working on all kinds of issues, or are they directed at certain issues in the present time in Asia?
They're everywhere in Asia, wherever there's a need. They're doing campaigns in Thailand about elephants. As you know, elephants are very much abused in Thailand for the tourists. They're beaten. They're forced to give people rides. So they're working on the elephant issue in Thailand.
Oh, yes. And various other issues,
yes,
depending on the country.
And right, like in Hong Kong and Japan are the more modern, high fashion cities. They're working on the fur issue, trying to get Burberry to stop selling fur. And they recently convinced Miss Universe, who is Japanese, to stop wearing fur. As well as they did some demos in Hong Kong during Fashion Week, where they jumped the stage and got a lot of media attention.
Hong Kong is really their center of operation, I guess, huh?
So they do have an office in Hong Kong and in Manila as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so pet operation overpopulation is another really big problem, as it is here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's just here we don't really see it that much. Mm-hmm. However, when you do look into it, shelters are filled with dogs and cats, and they're always being euthanized, and that's because people are buying animals from pet stores, which people should not be doing. People should be going to shelters and adopting animals.
Right. And now I imagine education is the number one effort that's being made, and I'm so pleased to hear that people are receptive to the animal rights issues. Can you tell us a bit about the kind of programs they're using to educate people besides what you were doing?
PETA basically is just they're very good with the media, so they're very good at getting media attention.
Yes.
I think that's basically the way they're educating people.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, whenever there's an opportunity to talk about the vegetarian issue, such as in the Philippines where there's a food crisis, they wrote a letter to the president and urged her to go vegetarian.
Oh yes.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
And that she responded to the letter, and that got front page everywhere. So after that, you know, people are very interested in this vegetarianism and food crisis issue, and people are making the connections and starting to talk about it.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, Ashley is working on these issues in one country herself, is she? Or does she have an intern?
She takes care of multiple countries.
Oh, she does. Yeah.
Yeah. So the entire Asia Pacific.
Yeah, Ashley Frumo is a well-known person in this area. She's the girl with all the courage to get rid of that rodeo, wasn't she?
She was, definitely. And she's doing great work in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
She's quite well-known in Asia as well.
Must take a bit of extra courage, though, when you're out of your own country to do these kind of dramatic efforts.
Yeah, well, when you see the animal suffering, which in Asia you do get to see a lot of it, not because there's more of it,
mm-hmm.
but because things are less hidden, they're more accessible to public view.
Ah, yes, there's a good point.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so
people who are doing unpleasant things to animals aren't as ashamed, I guess, as they are in this country because of all the information that we have.
Yeah, or they're less sophisticated and protected, mm-hmm. by big industries that are able to build up walls and, you know, get into universities and have big titles and torture animals that way.
Yeah.
So yeah, and we're just more sophisticated in the way we torture animals and hide it. Over there, it's just done in plain view.
Yeah. So what are the main impressions that you have after that month long visit of Asia?
I think it's very important to do outreach in Asia or to Asian communities, just because there's such a huge population. The world's biggest businesses have gone over to Asia, like KFC, McDonald's. All the big industries have gone over there for a reason, because there's so many people there. There's so many consumers there. And with all of that, with all the message from the big corporations, the other side is missing, the story about the animals.
Mm-hmm.
The activism is missing there. So that's why it's so important to be doing outreach in Asia or even to Asian communities where this information is new. and much needed.
Yes. Now, Carl has a question.
Now,
for you.
With the rise of the Southeast Asia as an economic power, mm-hmm. that means that the people are eating more meat as well.
Yes.
And so that's one aspect there that shows how important your education program is.
Exactly. Exactly. There's just so many people there. Even if you change, if you turn 1% of the population vegetarian, you'll be doing way more than anything you would.
Yeah, Ashley Frumo is a well-known person in this area. She's the girl with all the courage to get rid of that rodeo, wasn't she?
She was, definitely. And she's doing great work in Asia. Mm-hmm. She's quite well-known in Asia as well.
Must take a bit of extra courage, though, when you're out of your own country to do these kind of dramatic efforts.
Yeah, well, when you see the animal suffering, which in Asia you do get to see a lot of it, not because there's more of it, mm-hmm. but because things are less hidden. They're more accessible to public view.
Ah, yes, there's a good point.
Yeah, uh-huh.
People who are doing unpleasant things to animals aren't as ashamed, I guess, as they are in this country because of all the information that we have.
Yeah, or they're less sophisticated and protected mm-hmm. by big industries. They're able to build up walls and, you know, get into universities and have big titles and torture animals that way.
Yeah.
So yeah, and we're just more sophisticated in the way we torture animals and hide it. Over there, it's just done in plain view.
Yeah. So what are the main impressions that you have after that month-long visit of Asia?
I think it's very important to do outreach in Asia or to Asian communities, just because there's such a huge population. The world's biggest businesses have gone over to Asia, like KFC, McDonald's. All the big industries have gone over there for a reason, because there's so many people there. There's so many consumers there. And with all of that, with all the message from the big corporations, the other side is missing. The story about the animals, mm-hmm. the activism is missing there. So that's why it's so important to be doing outreach in Asia or even to Asian communities where this information is new. And much needed.
Yes, and now Carl has a question.
Now,
for you.
With the rise of the Southeast Asia as an economic power, mm-hmm. that means that the people are eating more meat as well.
Yes.
And so that's one aspect there that shows how important your education program is.
Exactly. Exactly. There's just so many people there. Even if you change, if you turn 1% of the population vegetarian, you'll be doing way more than anything you would be doing here, just because the people are, there's just so many more people.
Very interesting comments, Joanne. Thank you so much for taking time to do this. Now, I know.
Yes, and talking about being vegetarian, the vegetarian annual festival, Earth Saves Taste of Health, is coming up, next Friday. It starts at 6 o'clock, from 6 to 9 p.m. on Friday it starts, and then all day Saturday and Sunday, that's the 27th and 28th of September at the Croatian Cultural Center. It's a wonderful event where you want to just excite your taste buds, listen to speakers, demonstrations of food demonstrations, and meeting wonderful people who are into exactly what many of the issues that we speak about here on Animal Voices. So you can go to earthsave.ca and go to Taste of Health, and I'll be there most of the time. Please tap me on the shoulder. Would love to see you all there. Taste of Health. And next week we will be having Howard Lyman, who is one of the speakers on Friday evening. We will have him on Animal Voices for the full hour. That's on Animal Voices next Friday. So, yes, and Margie, you're still interested in the little beavers there? What are they doing to the beavers in Surrey?
Well, what they did was allow the destruction, the trapping of the beavers, the killing of them in Surrey. And remember, this is our national animal symbol. I think that has significance. What happened was there was a public outcry in the city of Surrey, As a result, after the trapping and killing of 40 of our national animals in the year, and that was only in 1 year, 40 of them were killed. Now, this devastating act authorized by the city included the killing of a father beaver, leaving the mother and young kits alone trying to fend for themselves. This trapping drew harsh criticism from even the president of the Lower Mainland Trappers Association. Fur bearer defenders' appearances in the Globe and Mail, the Surrey Leader, and the province newspaper spurred great public concern. And as a result, trapping is, let me tell you first of all, trapping is not a solution to the problem in Surrey. There are many alternatives, such as beaver deceivers and other various types of water flow devices that would allow us to live in harmony. Killing and removing the beavers from what is naturally their habitat will simply vacate the area for other beavers to move into. This only further perpetrates the cycle of cruelty and killing. Now, after letters and calls of criticism poured into the municipality, Surrey recently announced that they will be consulting with neighboring municipalities and spending up to $15,000 contracting environmental consultants to help them implement alternatives to trapping and killing. So this was a great advance and something that Fur Bearer Defenders, a group that's worked on this issue for over 30 years, be very, very happy about.
Okay, thank you much. Mm-hmm. And just to recap once again, that we had Alka Chandna on the line talking about animal experimentation. Her webpage is stopanimaltests.com, and our Animal Voices, our webpage is running for the Animal Defense and Anti-Vivisection Society. It's animalvoices.org/ADAV. It's up and running right now. So, I'd like to just, in closing, if you ever received a letter from Joanne Chang, she might say there, "Are you concerned about global warming? Then go vegan." According to the United Nations, almost a fifth of global warming emissions come from raising animals for meat, milk, and eggs. That's more emissions than from all the world's transportation combined. Thank you for listening to Animal Voices.